We are going through the steps, the 12 steps of AA, but we're going through them in kind of a non-traditional way. We're going through them trying to open them up for a completely general audience. But as we've said so many times in here before, everybody's recovering from something. Everybody's recovering from something, especially Steve right over there. And the way through whatever unfinished business that we still have in our lives that are coloring our attitudes toward life and the choices that we make, especially the obsessive compulsive patterns that we continually run through, is the same. It's Jesus' way. It's his way back to the Father, the only way to the Father. And we talked about last week how this is an active way. It's not passive. It's something that we really have to engage in. And so I wanted to pick up there where we left off as we move into now the seventh step. So we're moving kind of along here, but we are at the end of a four-step section that is completely concerned with moving us into a healing, moving us into a place where we can let go of all the things, the character defects and everything that has been dogging us all our lives, and the thing that continue to force the patterns in our lives, that force choices and decisions that break down relationship. We defined a character defect as something that harms relationship. And we said that it wasn't just behavior. It's not just bad behavior. It's the underlying cause. It's the underlying condition from which the bad behavior flows. And bad because it harms relationship, because it breaks things down. And it was interesting to me when I first started reading the steps why there were four steps concerned with this one issue of getting rid of our character defects. But now I see the wisdom in it completely. Step four, making a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves, is about awareness. It's about becoming aware of the patterns in our lives. Without awareness, there's no possibility for change. And so we have to become aware first. And so making that inventory, a physical list, is this process of becoming aware. But sometimes we think it's just this one thing that we do in a workshop or whatever. No, it's an ongoing process, and the 10th step reminds us of that. You know, that we're always going through this process of becoming more and more aware of the deeper and deeper things that still are keeping us running, keeping us on that hamster wheel, keeping us making decisions because of triggers that happen in our life. The second step, admitting this list to God and ourselves and another human being, is the part about forgiveness. It's about becoming part of the herd. It's admitting this, taking it out of ourselves, making it real, and then realize we can still be in relationship, even though we're imperfect. Who would have thought, huh? We keep thinking we got to be perfect in order to be in relationship, in order to be worthy of connection. And it turns out that's not true. Thank God it's not true, because when are we ever perfect? When do we ever not have another corner to knock off? When is a stone ever really smooth? And so by admitting this to God, another human being, we realize it hasn't changed the relationship. The relationship is still there. This gives us the basis, the fear-free basis from which to work to continue the process into the sixth step, which is to become entirely ready to have God remove our shortcomings. And we spent a lot of time on this last week, this idea of being entirely ready. What does it mean to be entirely ready? And I used a skydiving analogy. When was I entirely ready to trust that this parachute was going to break my fall? When I let go and let fall and started a sequence of events that was going to end at the ground one way or another. There was nothing I could do to take it back. When are we entirely ready to let God remove our shortcomings? When we start acting as if he already has. Now that might sound like a catch-22 to you, but it's really not. To start in the moment making decisions that take us into contrary action because we realize, yes, we're imperfect, but we're still in relationship. We're still worthy of connection. That gives us the freedom to be able to act as if that might actually be true. To try some things differently. Because we're aware of the defect, when it triggers in the moment, we recognize it, and we can actually take a breath and choose the opposite action, choose a contrary action. And over time, this is going to do something It's going to change something deeply in ourselves. Remember, character defects are not the bad behavior or the compulsive behavior itself. The defects drive the behavior. It's a chicken and egg thing, right? Cause and effect, symptom and disease. It's like that. Instead of just treating the symptoms, we're going to go right down to the disease. And the disease, the basic defect, the one that we all share as human beings, is existential fear. We're afraid that we're not acceptable ultimately. We're afraid that there's no one there for us ultimately. At the moment of our death, who's there? Is there anything there? Is anyone going to take our hand? That unknowing, that doubt, that lack of blessed assurance is the fear that drives everything else. All those seven deadly sins we talked about last week, all the manifestations of those sins in between the cracks that we talked about last week, all driven by this basic defect. So when you think about it, step six is becoming entirely ready. And I love that phrase because it speaks to the willingness to act. But entirely ready to do what? And we say to have God remove our shortcomings, but really what that is, if you think about it, is becoming entirely ready to see life from God's point of view. I want you to think about that for just a second. What does it mean to see life from God's point of view? See, the ancient Hebrews were huge on this. They understood us as human beings as living between heaven and earth. For as long as we're alive, down here breathing, we're living between heaven and earth. Heaven understood as the complete unity and connection and perfection of God, the Father in heaven, and earth as the place of individual form, of singularity, of the ability to see ourselves as separate, of physical need, of having to meet those needs. And so our job living as human beings between heaven and earth was to bring heaven to earth and earth to heaven, to merge the two. To find within our individual form and our ability to feel separation and loneliness and fear, to bring into that the awareness of the unseen world, this connection, this ultimate, absolute love and acceptance and forgiveness, to merge the two and be able to navigate and live our lives as if that reality were true, even in the midst of our fear. Because of that, life is always alternating, oscillating. Sometimes it looks like connection, sometimes it looks like fear, right? It's moving back and forth. That's why you see in the Bible these big switches and moves, you know? David, the beloved of God, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus doing the same thing, echoing David on the cross. We see these unharmonized bits just laid down side by side with no attempt to harmonize or to resolve them. Because to do so would be to negate the basic fact of life, that life is experienced this way, back and forth. You know, sometimes connection heaven and sometimes earth and sometimes not. So what we are looking at, since we are used to looking at life from our point of view, from the place of individual disconnection, fear and loneliness, and all the behavior that we need to try to self-medicate and to get through another day, to be able to turn that around and see it from God's point of view and see this unseen world, this unseen connection, this blanket of God's Spirit over everything. Are we entirely ready to do that? Because if we can do that, now we can merge heaven and earth. Now we can be fearless enough to let go of the behaviors that have been our friends, have been our teddy bears and our security blankets for decades in most cases. It's a difficult thing to do. But that's why there are four steps in this section. To create the awareness. To find the connection in the midst of our imperfection. And then to become entirely ready to let God and to humbly ask Him for that in step seven. I wanted to read something. You know, it's amazing to me sometimes how I'll be in the midst of a week or in the midst of preparation sometimes, and something will just come to my desk that is the perfect thing. I just love that, you know. I got an email from a friend that was probably there sitting in my box for a couple of days because that's how far behind I am on everything, it seems like. But I just read it yesterday morning as I was doing some initial prep for today. And I read this thing, and it's just like, wow, this is exactly what I wanted to talk about this morning. This comes from a woman who's got a ministry, and she puts out a one-pager, and I just want to read a couple of paragraphs from it. Because she writes, "There are many reasons I love snow, even snowstorms. One of them is the sparkling white stuff covers the litter on the sod as it settles upon it. The snow hides trash and beer cans and cigarette butts. I often see these, and worse, on my condo parking lot. Sadly, Atlanta rarely sees snow, so the trash is exposed no matter the season. A friend once expressed that if we could know everyone's personal hurts and fears and challenges, we'd all be much nicer to each other. People act the way they do for a reason. If the snow melted, snow in quotation marks, we would discover what lies beneath the facade, what lies under the very veneer of someone's personhood. The losses, the setbacks, the vicious battle trenches of sickness and crippling memories, addictions and disappointments. We are not privy to what lies beneath the lovely blanket of snow in probably well over 90% of the people we encounter." In Abba's Child, Brennan Manning describes how understanding leads to compassion. And this is a quote from the book. Author Stephen Covey recalled an incident while riding the New York City subway one Sunday morning. The few passengers aboard were reading the newspaper or dozing. Covey was engrossed in reading when a man accompanied by several small children boarded at the next stop. In less than a minute, bedlam erupted. The kids ran up and down the aisle, shouting, screaming, and wrestling with one another on the floor. Their father made no attempt to intervene. The elderly passengers shifted nervously. Stress became distress. Covey waited patiently. Surely the father would do something to restore some expression of paternal authority, anything. Nothing was forthcoming. Frustration mounted. After an unduly generous pause, Covey turned to the father and said kindly, "Sir, perhaps you could restore order here by telling your children to come back and sit down." "I know I should do something," the man replied. "We just came from the hospital. Their mother died an hour ago. I just don't know what to do." If we could know everyone's personal hurts, fears, challenges, and crippling memories, we'd all be much nicer to each other. With people you encounter, what might the disguise of snow be hiding? I remember seeing a movie once where a man and his wife were involved in a car accident. He lived and she died. And after all of the emergency vehicles and the trip to the hospital trying to save her life, there's a shot from inside his house as he opens the door and comes home again with blood on his shirt. And you just realize, you know, at the end of whatever anyone can do, you just have to come home with blood on your shirt. This man gets in a subway with his kids to go home after his wife died an hour ago in the hospital. And he's sitting there in shock as his kids wreak havoc on the subway, and everybody's just annoyed and irritated. If we, for a moment, could see the fears, could see the traumas and see the hurts, it reestablishes a human connection. It reestablishes the possibility of compassion. It reestablishes a connection. Trouble is, we don't get to see that very often, do we? But if we can start to see life from God's point of view, we know that the fears are there. And the reason we know they're there is because of the compulsive, destructive, dysfunctional behavior. Because when you see that, you're seeing the fear. It's the manifestation of it. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's dysfunction, there's fear. Take it to the bank. It's the way life works. Becoming entirely ready to see life and ourselves from God's point of view is seeing through to the fears and to the hurts and to the traumas that reestablish the human connection, that reestablishes the spiritual connection, that puts us back into the business of being compassionate again, of understanding, to be able to make a different choice rather than the one that's being triggered in us because of the dysfunctional behavior and the compulsive actions. It creates understanding. Jesus is always talking about loving the enemy because that is the quintessential expression of this absolute love of the Father. But it's not possible to do that unless we can see them as another human being, to see beneath what irritates us, what horrifies us, to the human being beyond. Even if we have to oppose them, either legally or with lethal force, because that's the situation we're in. After we do that, when we protect those who can't protect themselves, can we use this point of view of God to be able to then let go? To forgive in the sense of freeing ourselves from the bitterness and all of this, the stress and anxiety and frustration that would continue if we were not able to do that? This doesn't mean we could become doormats when we say love the enemy. It doesn't mean that we don't stand up for what our convictions tell us must be defended and protected. But what it does do is take us to the place where we can still see another human being there, a broken human being, a hurting human being. Jesus tells us not to judge for the same reason. The judgment is going to be based on looking at the blanket of snow. It's not going to be based on moving down. Because our own dysfunction clouds our judgment, clouds our ability to be able to make these good kind of judgments. We can't do it otherwise. And so all of this is of a piece. All of this is moving us through the sixth step and into the seventh. And here's the key. We can't do this for other people. We can't see other people this way until we can first do it for ourselves. To see ourselves this way. Now, from a negative point of view, Jesus says, you know, don't try to take the speck out of your brother's eye until you've taken the log out of yours, right? There's so many things that are wrong. We've got to see that stuff first. We've got to become aware of that stuff first. We've got to be able to choose differently in the moment first before we can ever have the clarity, have the presence and the mindfulness to be helping another person. But beyond that, we have to be able to forgive ourselves. We have to understand that we are still accepted and loved perfectly in the midst of our dysfunction and our obsessive compulsive behavior and our addictions and everything else. If we haven't got to that point ourselves, there's no way we can turn that light out to another person. It's not going to be possible. Once aware, once we're secure in our imperfection, then we can be entirely ready to see God's point of view, to move ahead. Ready to accept that we don't have to live in fear. We don't have to live this way. That change really is possible. We can do this. And we'll know that we're ready when we actually start to take that opposite action. Now, why do we have to act? Isn't God supposed to do the acting here? Isn't God supposed to be removing our defects of character? Isn't that His job? You know, yes. But, yes, but. We've been going through Richard Rohr's book on Wednesday, as Frank just pointed out a few minutes ago. And one of the things that we were talking about on Wednesday, because this is a book about contemplative prayer. It's about this business of seeing heaven in earth and connecting this way on a daily basis. And the language in the book is sometimes so paradoxical, you know, so zen-like, that it just doesn't seem to make any sense at all. We'll hit a paragraph or a sentence, and it's just like, what? And we have to stop and talk about it for a while and try to parse it out. Because it just doesn't make legal sense. You know, people just don't talk that way in normal life. And there's a reason for that. It's because these things that we're trying to express from a spiritual point of view defy regular logical thinking. Defy the way that we normally process the things that we do in our daily activities. And so they have to be stated in this other way, and they don't make any sense until you've had the first few experiences of what it feels like to merge heaven and earth, what it feels like to see the world for that, even that flash from God's point of view. And then all of a sudden, bam, it just clicks in. And you realize not only did it need to be said that way, it's the only way it could be stated. Why does Jesus sound the way Jesus does? Why does He speak in such paradox? Don't you just sometimes get frustrated and say, why don't you just say it straight out, Lord? Why does it have to be all this stuff? You know, if you want to be first, you have to be last. And if you have to pick up your cross and you got to hate your father and mother and let the dead bury the dead when I just want to go home and bury my father. No, let the dead. All of these things. Lord, your mother and your brothers are out there. Who is my mother? Who are my brothers? Oh, please, will you just go out and say hi? It's the only way these things can be expressed. To express it any other way is to miss this deep and constantly alternating, oscillating experience of life between heaven and earth, between our point of view and God's point of view. There's no other way to get this done, you know? And it's the same thing here with the sixth step moving into the seventh. The sixth step makes us ready to be able to comprehend what the seventh is all about. We wouldn't be able to do that without the experiences of the entirely ready part, without experiences of these moments without fear. The words will not make sense to humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. We're not going to know what that means. We're going to misunderstand. These are the words that we're going to address today. We're going to humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. And they're just words until we're entirely ready to act on life from God's point of view, to get those first experiences, to feel those first connections, to see the connection under the disconnection, to see the love under the blanket of fear. And so this step seven, to humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings, usually focuses on God's action, doesn't it? God is the actor. We're asking Him for a result. Asking God to remove. It's passive. We're asking, God's going to do all the work. But really, the focus should be on the humbly asking part. That's really the key. That's active. That's partnering with God. How are we supposed to humbly ask? How are we going to do this? First of all, is it humble at all to presume that you can partner with God? Isn't that a little presumptuous in and of itself? How is it humble for me to say I can partner with God? See, we Christians have a big problem with that, because we're big on God's sovereignty. We're big on the pyramid. God is up at the top and we all fan out in some kind of hierarchy based on how well we do in life. So to talk about partnering with God sounds like sacrilege, even blasphemy. Certainly a lot of hubris, certainly a lot of pride. But let's take a look at Micah 6, because I think Micah has something for us right there. Verse 6 to 8, it's in your bulletins. Or take a look, I think James is right on top of it, aren't you, James? Yeah, he's giving me the high sign there. Micah writes in a very famous passage, "With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the Lord, before the God on high? Shall I come to Him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams, in 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." Or as it's translated down in the picture there, act justly, love mercy, walk humbly. You see, the Jews were all about the sacrificial system, the temple system. And Micah is making a distinction here. Can't miss it. Can't see what Micah's trying to do to get us to understand. The sacrificial system is about passive acting, asking. It's about putting the sacrifice on the altar and then God doing all the work. He cleans me. He cleanses me. He allows me, through the temple priests, who are actors in this, to come back into community when I have been separated. The focus is all on God's action. But Micah is saying, that's not what God is after. What He's after is for us to do justice, to love mercy and kindness, and to walk humbly with our God. It's active. It's something that we do. It's an acute move with God to act as God acts, to value what God values. Everything that God is becomes a part of who we are, and then it's reflected in everything we do. But it's not about a passive acting and God does. It's about us moving in. It's truly a partnership with God. We are God's hands and feet. Malkutha, the word for kingdom that Jesus uses, means a resonance with the Father. It's not a one-way dictatorial rule. It's two ways. It's the people resonating with the will of the King, the delight and the pleasure of the King, taking that on themselves. So literally they act out They do everything in kingdom that needs doing because of their deep connection with the Father. This is what Micah is trying to get across. This is what I believe the 6 and 7 steps are trying to get across too. There is something that we do that moves us into. That doesn't mean that we're earning anything in terms of God's love. That's already there. But if we're going to realize it in our lives, if we're going to move through this function, there is something that we need to do. And so, what is this humility then? You know, there are misconceptions in the way we think about humility, just colloquially, just in our language, that I think we need to clear up. And I thought the best way to do that was to take a look at how hard it is for all of us to accept a compliment. Do you know how hard it is to accept a compliment? How hard is it for you to accept a compliment if someone compliments you? Have you ever been around someone that you tried to give a compliment to and they couldn't just take it? I mean, what is it about that? What's that thing, that psychological tick in our head? You know, I love your shirt. Oh, this old thing? I got it on the clearance rack. I love your shirt. Oh, really? I only wore this because I had nothing else to wear. That's a great hairstyle on you. I hate my hair. I wish I had hair like yours. Looks like I cut it wearing a bowl. You look great. I need to lose 10 pounds. Wow, you look really pretty today. You must be blind. Good job. Well, I could have done better. I'm not really smart. I just got lucky. Oh, it was easy. Anyone could have done it. How many times do we hear things like that? How many times do we say things like that? Norman Richard writes, in the popular conception, humility consists in having a low opinion of yourself, or possibly in underestimating yourself. Humble people are expected to be modest and self-deprecating. They are supposed to say, it was nothing, really, when we all think it was marvelous. Henry Nouwen wrote about a low point in his life. I am tempted to wallow in my own lostness and lose touch with my original goodness, my God-given humanity, my basic blessedness, and thus allow the powers of death to take charge. This happens over and over again. Whenever I say to myself, I am no good, I am useless, I am worthless, I am unlovable, I am a nobody, there are always countless events and situations that I can single out to convince myself and others that my life is just not worth living. That I am only a burden, a problem, a source of conflict, or an exploiter of other people's time and energy. This is not humility. This is humiliation. There's a difference. Humiliation is reducing or lowering to a lower position. And it happens to both ourselves and the giver. When we accept compliments, we are actually behaving with more humility. Because if we disregard what other people say, then we are basically denying the possibility that they can see something in us that we can't see in ourselves. Denying that they have the ability to perceive clearly. The subtext is, I know better than you. Just say thank you. What a concept, huh? You look great today. Thank you. By accepting the gift, you honor the giver. By accepting the gift, you honor the giver. When you give a gift, what is the worst thing that can happen? A gift is not accepted, right? It's a slap in the face. How does that make you feel? Why are we doing to each other? Why do we do this? And, you know, then it moves over into the Christian realm. You know, you compliment somebody. What do they say? Oh, it wasn't me. It was the Lord. All glory goes to God. Now, while that's true, it's also really, really demeaning at the same time. It's just a sneaky way of doing the same thing. Now, many really believe that is what humility requires. No, it's God. It wasn't me. But how does that still make the giver feel? You still didn't honor them by accepting their gift to you. You lowered them. You humiliated them. Even with your well-intentioned attempt to try to honor God. Or maybe it's a false humility. Maybe it's really a form of self-aggrandizement. You know, trying to raise your position, making you look better because now you're somehow allied with God and God's plan. You know, just shut up and say thank you. That's all we got to do. Accept the gift. Say thank you. All these things that we try to do to deflect humiliates the giver, makes them feel lower. Now, some of us don't even believe in humility as a virtue. They really believe that we're supposed to be doing all this by ourselves. Aristotle, famous Aristotle, right? He regarded humility as a vice rather than a virtue. He saw humility as small-spiritedness. As far as he was concerned, humble people lack ambition and don't dare to dream of going for the gold. These people hold back from fine actions and practices and equally from external goods because they think they are unworthy of them. Well, that's true, but that's not humility. He's missing the point in terms of how we're trying to define it. Between humiliation and aggrandizement is a simple seeing of ourselves and reality as we really are. That's humility. Seeing ourselves as we really are. And how is that? Well, dependent, vulnerable, imperfect, dysfunctional, and at the same time, completely and utterly loved, accepted, forgiven, connected, and worthy of connection. All those heaven and earth things at the same time. That's who we really are. We didn't earn it, but we get to keep it. It's a gift. It's a gift we could never give ourselves. And in that space of gratitude, we find the true meaning of humility. True humility, the ability to see ourselves as ourselves, life as itself, God as God is, creates this sense of gratitude. The sense of contentedness that this moment is sufficient, that's humility. That's what we're after. Have you ever noticed a very young child when he or she gets a compliment? They not only say thank you, they also tell you what else they can do. Yeah, and I can do this and this and this and this and this. It's great. That's how we should be. Is it humble to believe we can partner with God? You betcha. Because all we're doing is seeing life as it is. God doesn't do everything for us. God can move mountains. We got to bring the shovel. There's a part for us to play in all of this. Play our part. Let's do it. Let's move for it. All right? Now, what did Jesus say about this? Let's look at John 5. Jesus made an answer and said, "Truly I say to you, the Son is not able to do anything himself. He is able to do only what he sees the Father doing. Whatever the Father does, the Son does it the same way." See the partnering there? John 5:30. "Of myself, I am unable to do anything." Jesus? "Of myself, I am unable to do anything. As the voice comes to me, so I give a decision." Don't you love that? "As the voice comes to me, so I give a decision." What voice? The voice of his Father with whom he is always in connection, of whose presence he is always aware. "As the voice comes to me, I make my choice. I make my decision." Stepped away from all of the human frailties, obsessive, compulsive needs that he worked to purge, to the point of exhaustion in the wilderness before he began his public ministry. "As the voice comes to me, so I give a decision. And my decision is right because I have no desire to do what is pleasing to myself, but only what is pleasing to him who sent me." This is Jesus. He's talking about this very phenomenon. Partnered with God, in awareness with God, he can make these good decisions. He can be sinless as he moves forward. But this is Jesus. What about us? I'm not Jesus. You're not Jesus. Last time I checked. What are we supposed to do? Can we really take this to the bank? Take a look at John 14, starting at verse 10. "Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works themselves. Truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do, and greater works than these will he do because I am going to the Father." Jesus is showing us this way. He's showing us what human beings are capable of connected to his Father. We can do this. partnered with God, we can move and live in this freedom, this place of fearless love. We can do this, Jesus is telling us. So how are we going to do this humbly asking? How do we humbly ask? All right? Humbly, accepting who we are, fully loved, fully accepted, but there's no shame now in all the things that we are aware of, our dependence and our vulnerability and all of our imperfection. By accessing our humility, we have created a basis for ourselves, a reality of humility that allows us to be fearless enough to proceed with the asking part. So what's the asking part? Jesus shows us that too. Take a look at Matthew 7, starting in verse 7. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and everyone who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, it will be opened. Now, read just that way in English, it sounds again pretty passive. We're just asking, well, seeking is active. You know, doesn't have a lot of teeth in it, you know, and knock and it's going to be opened. But when you translate that back into the Aramaic, we start to see what's really happening here. To ask in Aramaic is selu. Selu is related by root to the word for prayer. To pray in Aramaic is selah. If you read the Psalms, often you see a little break in the lyric and you see selah. That's a moment of prayer. But selah is a hunting term. Literally, it meant to go into the woods and clear a space and lay a trap and cover it over carefully with leaves and branches, to retire into a blind, to patiently wait, expectantly wait on a hair trigger, quietly, alertly, waiting for the trap to spring so that you can move into action, expectantly waiting for something to happen, every sense on a hair trigger. Inclining toward, leaning in. It's like that body language when you really are interested in something someone is saying and you lean in. That's selah. Selu is like that. It's an asking, but it's not a passive asking. It's like a police interrogation. There's a drive behind it. There's a desire behind it. You really want to know. This is something on which everything depends to you. It's like the rich young man coming and asking Jesus, what must I do to obtain eternal life? There's a deep, deep desire behind it. That kind of asking, Jesus says, is not going to be denied. With that kind of desire, with that kind of drive, as long as that desire drives you to the next piece, the seeking, be'ah in Aramaic, which means a diligent search from inside to outside. A willingness to overturn every single rock, no matter where it takes you, no matter how scary or unfamiliar it may be, you're willing to walk down those paths because your desire, your drive of selu is pushing you forward. Jesus, it says, was driven into the wilderness by the Spirit. Exbalo in the Greek. But it's the same kind of drive of desire, this wanting and willingness to move forward into be'ah, into the seeking. And then finally, to knock is koshv, which is really a strange one because it literally means to pitch a tent or to strike a musical note. What does that have to do with what we're talking about here? Well, it makes sense in terms of knocking, striking a note, right? But pitch a tent? The idea here is when you strike a note, you have created something that everyone now can participate in. You have realized something. Before, maybe you heard the note in your head, but now you have made it real. It's vibrations in the air for everybody, the community. When you pitch a tent, you create a space that can shelter people underneath it. The idea of knocking here is to realize, to manifest the reality of that which you have been seeking, that which you had the desire to ask for in this intense way. Ask, seek, and knock. Selu, be'ah, kosh are a process. Just like the 12 steps are a process. This is one that's just cut down in a simpler form. But all the steps are there. Jesus is saying, if you're going to ask, this is how you ask. And the beautiful thing is that to ask and to pray in Aramaic is almost exactly the same concept. Because it's so closely related by the root words. How are we supposed to pray? Jesus was asked that too, with that same kind of intensity by his followers. How are we supposed to pray? And he said, when you pray, pray like this. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, as in heaven, so on earth. There's that between heaven and earth part. Your kingdom come, your will be done, as in heaven, so on earth. This merging again of everything, putting it together. Realizing that our true state here on earth is one of this fear, the fear of loneliness, the fear of separation. But that there is another reality, heaven, that can be brought down. And all we have to do is merge in our will, in our desire, to see life from both sides, to bring the two together, to become entirely ready to accept God's state and God's nature, which is love and unity for us, that overlays the state that we find ourselves in and brings it all together. To move forward, to act as if our nature was already part of and connected with God. As in heaven, so on earth. Your kingdom come, your will be done. As we do this, as we move out, as if these things are already true, we find that they are. We find that the two become one. Asking in action is really what the step is about. Praying in action is what the Lord's Prayer is all about. And when we do that, we will find that we have figured out how to humbly walk with our God. Let's pray. Once again, Father, we give you permission to take us wherever we need to go, no matter how unfamiliar, no matter how frightening, no matter how risky it seems. We're going to stipulate right here, right now, that you are who you say you are, that you are who Jesus says you are, that really there is no risk, that really everything comes out all right in the end for everyone who loves you and walks according to your purpose. That's what we want to do, Father. We want to leave the fear behind. We want to leave the dysfunction behind. We want to move into new vistas and new ways of relating with you and with each other. Help us to see how to do that. Help us to become aware in the moment of the things that keep us from you. Help us to fall into your embrace, to turn to you, and to find that you have never left, you've never forsaken, and you're always right here, closer than our next breath. You're our God, we're your people. We love you, Lord, because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.